Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Oliver Wakeman. Wakeman celebrates 20 years of his album Mother's Room with a newly remixed, remastered, and expanded edition of the record titled Mother's Room 20th Anniversary Edition. It's out March 13th. In addition to the record release, Wakeman will team up with his father, Rick Wakeman, for a run of U.S. concert dates, beginning just as this new version of Mother's Room is commercially available. Dubbed Wakeman and Son, the shows will provide audiences with a rare opportunity to see the two men play side by side. Like his father, the younger Wakeman has served as a member of both the Straubs and Yes, and he'll celebrate his time with and appreciation for the latter band via UK concerts this spring and fall, titled the From a Page Tour, during which he'll also highlight his original works. We discussed revisiting Mother's Room, the upcoming U.S. tour, and Wakeman's love for the American band Styx. That's Oliver Wakeman on Into Music, coming up now.
Happy to be talking to you about the reissue of Mother's Room. The record sounds phenomenal. I know that this was part of the re-release, was kind of going back, revisiting, right, maybe correcting some things. So when did that opportunity kind of present itself that you could go in and, you know, rework this?
Well, I was working with Mercury on a couple of other projects. I got chatting to them because I did a few reissues a few years ago. So I've been working my way through my back catalogue and getting the records back out. That's the nicest way of saying this. As a musician, you have to find a point when you finish a record and go, okay, that's done. I now have to release it, because otherwise, like most creative people, you will consistently keep iteratingly trying to make something better and better and better. So you always find a point at which you have to stop. Lots of things can influence that. It can be time, it can be studio availability, it can be the amount of money you've got to finish a record. The original record had some quite tight constraints on it, both financially and time constraints, and technological as well. I mean, this is 20 years ago. That doesn't sound like a lot to me, but it's actually technologically, it's a long way. We've come a long way in 20 years, particularly in the music recording world. And so when I spoke to Mercury, I said, I'd like to re-release this record. Would you be interested? And they said, yeah, let's go and have a listen to it. And they listened to it and said, yeah, great, we'll put it back out as it is. And I sort of said, well, actually, you know, I think I can make it better because, you know, the mix, the guy that mixed it, Carl Groom, who I work with on every record I do, and he worked on the Yes records with me, he's a fantastic audio engineer. But it was done back in the days where keyboards were being run a lot through MIDI, so you create a MIDI environment using keyboards and a computer, and then you have another computer that was dealing with, which was Pro Tools, which was dealing with the audio side of things. It was a period of time when the unless you had a really, really powerful system, they couldn't handle the two at the same time, so you then had to do the time code between two machines to get them working, which meant that when you were recording, you were still using a physical old-fashioned desk to actually do the faders on the audio stuff, but you were having all the keyboards coming in a virtual sense, which meant that you had to do everything with a piece of paper and go fader 9 up to 12 for this point. And there's, you know, two of us with our hands on the faders trying to get everything sorted, a little bit of automation. And we only had like two or three runs through to get each song right with the time that we had. And so I was very happy with the record when it came out, but it was only when I sort of thought, okay, let me just have a re-listen to it. So I listened to the record and I thought, yeah, it's still good. And then I kind of went into the original files, and as I was going through the original files, I sort of thought, hang on, that's missing. Where did that go? And where did that go? Because when you finish the record, you're so excited that you finish the record and it turns up and you go, oh, wow, that's great. That sounds great. So anyone actually went back, you suddenly went, oh, I forgot about that part. We didn't actually get that part in there at that point. And actually, we were supposed to do that bit as well. And actually, maybe those guitars are a little bit loud and maybe we can make the keyboards a little bit more balanced. And so you suddenly start tweaking. And it wasn't just that sort of tweaking for the sake of it. It was that tweaking of actually going, actually, this is actually making it sound how I wanted it to sound when I first did it. And with the advances in technology now, the way that you can split tracks apart and that you can do a lot more work at home and actually get a balance as to how you feel it's right before you start involving other people, it just allowed me to sort of get the record sounding, I suppose, just a little bit more vibrant. It's, the original record was great, but it had a sort of slightly darker feel to it. Now it feels a lot more vibrant and a lot more balanced across the instruments.
First thing I generally do is just ignore the press release on first listen, just so I have, just have my ears open. And I was like, man, this sounds, and then I was like, oh, this is 20 years, what? Because it does, it sounds so present and now.
It did surprise me actually when I sort of went back to it and sort of went, actually, this is probably quite ahead of its time at the time 20 years ago. But it's probably why it was a slightly heavier guitar mix, I think, back then. Because back in the, I mean, we're talking, what, the early 2000s or mid 2000s, and it was, prog was going through a very sort of heavy guitar section then. Keyboards had taken another bit of a step back. Throughout the 90s, we sort of had the sort of neo-prog revival, where things were very keyboard orientated and the guitars were a little bit secondary. Then through the early 2000s, it kind of went the other way. And we had a lot of bands like Dream Theater and stuff leading the way in which way the guitars were leading. And so I think that, our mix at the time probably was influenced by the sound of what other records were doing. And so when I got to this one and bought the keyboards back in, and of course I could update a few of the sounds, make things a little bit crisper and cleaner. Carl's mastering technique, he was able to raise the level of the record a little bit and just make it sparkle a bit more. And I think that's really helped it. And actually now when I listen to it, in comparison to the albums that I've done recently, like I did a record called Anam Cara a couple of years ago, and the audio quality and the dynamics of it sound very similar, which is really nice because that's kind of what you want from records. You want people to, particularly now when people can go and buy back catalogues quite quickly, they can pick up and lots of different things. And you want people to be able to jump between records that might be 20 years apart and actually go, oh, I like that one. Oh, that one's good. That one's good. Whereas when I was younger and I would listen to bands that I really liked that had did a record maybe in the late 60s and then in the late 70s, they were so different in style because everything had changed so quickly. It's one of the advantages of being able to go through a back catalogue is that you can actually get a lot of music very, very quickly. But then the other side of the coin is that not all the records are going to sound the same, and you can often jump in between time periods and not actually follow a chronological route of a band's history. So it's really interesting as to how we sort of approach music like that, and particularly with streaming now, you don't even get somebody to know they're actually going to listen to the whole album. They're just going to hear one track and then find another track.
There's something about your writing, and it's evident to me on this album and some of the others that I tend to think of your compositions as being very story focused, as opposed to like, here's a verse chorus, but that there's some sort of bigger, I don't, maybe scheme is too big of a word for it, but I think you know what I'm saying. They're very story driven.
Yeah, I've always been a big reader, so I've always read loads of books, and I watch films and things, but books were my thing when I was growing up, and I've always loved that sort of story arc and the development of a character, and I think songwriting allows you that ability to bring stories to life through music, and also I also find that music is very cathartic if you've got issues or things that are going on or things that you would like to talk about. And I'm not a political songwriter, so I don't sit there and write a song about how awful something is or how terrible something is. But I do have situations in my own life where things have happened and I've sort of gone, oh, that wasn't very nice or that didn't make me feel very good. But rather than just sit there and write a song and go, I'm unhappy because this happened to me. I tend to try and think of it more in a story. I tend to try and think of a scenario and actually take myself, how I felt or what happened to me, and put it into a story and actually go, how would I write that character's story? How would I write about what that character's feeling? How would I do that? So I do spend a lot of time thinking about things that way. And sometimes I can be just jotting a load of lyrics down. A good example is I wrote a song called Credit Carnival on a record I did called Ravens and Lullabies many years ago. And that was all about somebody in a gambling casino. And I wrote the lyrics without any of the music after a show when I used to perform with the band Yes. And it was after one of our shows. We all went around the casino and I was just walking around the casino writing these lyrics of these people that I was watching. And I started to create this character who was there, who was having some money issues and was desperately hoping that the next win would get him out of the money trouble. And I wrote this whole story about it. And then I came back to the music. And it's those sort of things that I really enjoy doing. And on Mother's Ruin, there's a couple of tracks on there which are quite long, what I sort of term epic-y sort of tracks. And one of them was about an unscrupulous agent many years ago that tried to maybe make a deal that wasn't actually in everyone else's best interest. And I wrote this story about this band being promised the earth and how they were the greatest thing ever. But actually, it was a bit of a sort of a dark lord taking over their lives. And another song on there, which is the final track, which is called Wall of Water, I wrote because I was on my way. I was quite young when I first started writing the lyrics to this one. And I was one lunchtime, I went down to a shop just to buy something. And on my way down to the shop, I passed an alleyway and there was this drunk bloke there. And he started talking to me and he was quite pleasant. So I chatted away, a bit inebriated and having a bit of a joke and blah, blah, blah. And I sort of chatted away and then said, okay, thanks very much. Nice to see you. Bye-bye. And went off down to the shop. I was in the shop for about 20 minutes. And by the time I walked back past him, he had gone past the point of being pleasant to the point of being aggressive and unpleasant. And he started to be quite verbal and not a very nice person to be around. And I went back and wrote this story called Wall of Water about that descent into that fall, like a wall of water dragging you down. And that you've sort of got to really swim against the tide to try and get out of that sort of downward spiral. So it's those sort of stories that I tend to do in my head rather than sit there and write, I went to the shop today, la-di-da-di-da, somebody shouted at me, la-di-da-di-da. You know, I find it much more enjoyable to think of these stories. And being a sort of musician where musicality is quite an important part of what I do, that does allow me the sort of liberty to be able to take the music in different areas and actually have different sounds and different instruments try and represent different emotions. And I find that really exciting. And from a writing point of view, you know, it can also mean that sometimes you're writing a song that may be a traditional introduction, verse, couple of choruses sort of approach, you know, and then it's maybe a middle eight or a solo. So, but sometimes it also allows you the point of actually just through composing and thinking, actually, there isn't really a structure here. It's a story. So I don't have to conform to what people would perceive is the route that you should follow. You know, sometimes stories, you don't know they're finished until they're finished. That, you know, the song tells you when it's finished. You don't know yourself. I find that very difficult to go, right, this is the end. It's, maybe there's another section to come yet. I haven't quite worked that out yet. But it's I find songwriting fascinating. I really do.
We should also talk about the fact that you're going to come over to the States with your father, Rick Wakeman. And for people who don't know, this is not like the two of you have spent decades sitting down with two family pianos. You haven't played together a whole lot across your lives, right? So this is a unique opportunity.
It is, actually. I mean, you know, obviously Dad is very well known for his career. And in an odd sort of way, I've always taken an independent path, which may sound odd when people think that I've played with the Straubs and with Yes as well. But those were jobs that I didn't court. They came to me, phoned me up and said, would you like to join the band? We really, you know, sometimes you know, sometimes there was the element that the Straubs in particular said, we'd really like to go out and play some of the music that your dad was involved with, but it's quite hard to get a keyboard player that plays that sort of style that can pick up that sort of music and that ability, which was very flattering. But the thing that I had was, I've always been very independent. So it was a case of, okay, well, I approach all these jobs, and same with Yes, the same way any other keyboard player that might have got this job would be, which is, I go and get the CDs, I sit there, I listen to them, I try and work out what's going on, I try and chart it out, I try and find the way that I would make it work. And I approached it that way. So going out with Dad on tour is really something I'm really looking forward to do, because I feel like I've had my own pathway on my career, which has been very much me doing what I want to do. I haven't played with lots of different people. I've had collaborations along the way and played with a few different bands and done different tours, but I'm not a constant out there playing with. I've always sort of decided that I'd rather do the writing, creating projects, creating records that I enjoy. So Dad and I had never really played the piano growing up, till my dad and mum separated when I was quite young. So my dad wasn't around for a lot of it anyway. But I don't think to this day we've ever sat down and I've said, how do you do that? And he said, it's like this. We've never done that. And he's never offered it, but I've never asked either. And I think that's probably worked quite well, because when we do get together and do shows, which has only been a few, we've done maybe five or six different things together, usually one-off shows, or, you know, a show where we're doing two shows in one evening or something. And we sort of generally turn up and Dad says, this is what I want to do. And I go, okay. And then we sort of have a day to work it out. And then we do it. The only time we've ever actually really sat down and had, I would have said, a day, proper day's rehearsal, was when I did the big King Arthur show with him at the O2 in London. And that was because it was very specific second keyboard parts that he wanted to work with his main keyboard parts. So he scored out everything for me, came over and we sat down and he said, this is what I need. It wasn't me saying, what, you know, how do I play this? He said, this is what I need you to play. And so it's okay, well, I'll chart all that out and we'll do that. So when he phoned me up last year and said, I'm going out to America to do some shows, you know, I was trying to think of something different to do. And he said, you know, we've never actually done a tour together. Would you like to come and do that? And I sort of thought to myself, actually, do you know what? I'm older now. I've done quite enough music that people would know that I have my own career, that I have my own, I've taken my own pathway. And I felt, yeah, actually, this would be nice to do it now. He's getting older. It would be a very nice thing to do, to go out with him, spend some time with him on the tour, and, you know, play some music together. And he was, you know, he's very keen to play some Yes tracks and, you know about the stuff that I did with Yes. And so it's sort of, it's just sort of come at the right time. You know, it's actually like a nice thing to do. And I'm really looking forward to it. And we're going through lots of music, you know, that I grew up with of Dad's, and I'm sort of learning some of it for the first time. I've never played it before. I, you know, a lot of people think, because of my family history, that I was born, and then for the next 15 years of my life, the guys from Yes would come over and have a cup of tea every evening, and we'd all sit down and play Yes music together next to a family. Nothing like that, you know, it didn't happen. Dad and I, when we would get together, we talk about comedy or we talk about cars. That's what we talk about. We, you know, music doesn't really come into it. We just talk about things that dads and sons are interested in, which generally comedy and cars between my dad and I. So when it comes to music, it's not our first conversation. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, it's going to be a lot of fun. It'll be good fun. But it'll be interesting to actually spend, you know, a prolonged period of time together as we're getting older. I'm looking forward to it. I'm generally really looking forward to it.
So I imagine there was not a time, for instance, either where I think some fans would probably say, oh, well, you know, Oliver and Dylan Howe were running together and forming bands. That was also not part of the picture, right? The second generation of Yes.
No, I mean, I do know Dylan. I didn't know Dylan. I knew his brother who passed away, unfortunately, Virgil. You know, I knew those two. And but no, it never really got into anything like that, to be honest with you. We just it I mean, there's, you know, there's, my dad tells me things. He said, like, you know, when you were really little, he said, and I was working with Bowie, he said, you used to come over with us to Bowie's house and play with Zowie. And it was like, great, but I was probably about 4 months old. I don't remember it. I don't remember these things. It's lovely to think that that was a part of my life, but you don't really remember that stuff when you're I mean, I went to the very first Journey to the Center of the Earth concert, the one that was recorded, and I was, what was I, 25 months old, 2 years and 2 months old. I've still got the T-shirt in a suitcase in the garage, but I don't remember it. I've got no memory of it. It's lovely to think I was there. So my memories of, you know, my memory of Dylan Howe in particular was I went over to see Dad play when he was with Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman and Howe when they did that tour many years ago. And that was 1989. I was 17. And what was interesting about that tour was that Dad had invited myself and my brother over, and Steve Howe had invited Dylan over as well, his son. And they went to the studio to do some recording for a track. And I was in the studio, and I spent all my time in the studio talking to Steve Howe, and he was showing me guitars and talking to me about guitars and how he was going to approach the song. And I was like fascinated sitting there listening to him. And over in the other, I could see into another booth next door, and there was Dylan Howe talking to Bill Bruford, who was explaining to him all about drums and how he should approach drums. And obviously Bill being a fantastic jazz drummer, and Dylan, you know, emulating that as being a fantastic jazz drummer. It was really interesting. And you know, Dad's been a huge influence on me by me listening to his music and what he's achieved. But then I also had a great friendship with Steve Howe because of that time that I spent with him in the studio. As years went by, I then worked on a radio station, and Steve lived not far away from me. And one day I was hitchhiking back, and I got to it, and I had a train ticket to take me part of the way, and I was at a train station, and Steve was picking up his sons from the train station, and I got talking to Steve again, and he said, oh, you must come over. And I went, oh, that'd be lovely. We didn't live too far away from each other. And I got a job on a radio station, and I interviewed him for the radio station. Then he would invite me over to talk about stuff, and then I did my first record. And he said, I'd love to have a copy of the record. So I sent him a copy, and then he thought, I'll never hear anything again. He phoned me up and said, really like your record. I've made some notes. Would you like to hear what I think? And it was like, lovely, that tremendous, you know. And then he invited me over to his house again, and then we got talking, and then he said, play me some other things you've written. So I started to play him pieces I'd written, and then he got involved in one of the records I did called The Three Ages of Magic, which he then played guitar over. So oddly enough, my career actually didn't actually involve working with his son. It actually ended up working with Steve, and then many years that led to me working with him in Yes when they pulled it all back together in 2008. So it's really odd. My sort of history with Yes comes from a later point in life than I think most people would think it did. Because, you know, by 1977, I was five. Dad was living in Switzerland, and I think they were all living in Switzerland recording, going for the one in Tomato. You know, it wasn't really a period of life. You know, Dad had left Yes twice by the time I was five. And when you think of that, and that's their, you know, that was their heyday, really. Yeah, and then he didn't rejoin again until that late 80s period, which is when I got involved with it all.
Well, just kind of one final thing. I have to tell you that I've been following you on Facebook for some time, and so I was born late 72. I think you're probably in that.
Yeah, I'm early 72, yeah.
Yeah. So it's been interesting to me to see you like talk about Rush albums or Styx albums and that you have some of the same thoughts. And it was also curious to me that you had that appreciation for Styx, who are so American, and I don't even know that they've been to the UK in decades, maybe.
No, I mean, I credit lots of bands with inspiring me over the years and influencing what I do. So basically, Dad was a big influence on me because of what he does. I enjoy his humor. I enjoy the sort of energy and humor that he injects into his records. I enjoy storytelling, as I mentioned earlier. I love history. I'm his son. I seem to have a lot of the same sort of interests. So when he does records on King Arthur and Journey to the Center of the Earth, I love all that. I love the fun. I love the sounds that keyboards create. I like all that sort of stuff. But there are other bands that I discovered along the way as I was growing up that really, really hit home with me and really influenced different parts of what I do. And as I've grown up and become more of a songwriter and an arranger and things, you suddenly draw on these experiences. And you don't just sit there and go, oh, okay, I'm going to copy something that Deep Purple did. You go, what was it about the way they approached something that really made something connect with you? So I grew up with those sort of bands that did that. And Styx was one of those bands. And Styx, yeah, they weren't well known over in the UK. They were on A&M Records. And when my dad had left many years before, and my mum was having a clear out of the attic, and I had a record player, and she came down with this bundle of records and said, look, these were your dad's old records. Do you want them? Or they're just going to go. And I looked at it, and it was like Tales from Topographic Oceans, going for the one. I think there might have been a copy of Hunky Dory in there. And then there was The Grand Illusion by Styx with a A&M demonstrator sticker on it. And I thought, yeah, okay, great. And I put The Grand Illusion on. And I thought, this is amazing. And then Miss America hit me. And I must have been 13, 14, something like that when I first heard it. And the idea that you could sing a line like Miss America, won't you Miss America? And that word being used in two different contexts. As a young man, as a young lad, that was like the cleverest thing ever. And I just went, wow, that's really interesting. It's just the use of language you can really do things with. And then I sort of listened to the story behind it, thought, wow, I really get the story as well. And what I really loved about Styx, I should probably explain what we're doing about with the Facebook. So I do a lot of talking about memorabilia from my time in bands that have influenced me, historical things, going out for what I just talk about things that I find interesting. And oddly enough, about 17,000 people seem to find it interesting as well, which is really nice. But when I listened to Styx, I listened to them and I thought, this is really interesting, because I'd listened to bands like Deep Purple that were sort of very rock blues sort of approach to things. And then I listened to Yes, who are quite complex, and they took a song and then sort of stretched it as far as they could. Whereas Styx took a bit of a middle ground where the song was still key, the song was still the main element of the song, and all the instrumentation went around the songs to enhance the song. Gave them some freedom to be a little bit experimental and push envelopes, but not to the point where they were trying to push it as far as they humanly could, to the point that the song was actually a small element of this larger piece of music. And I really love that about Styx. And I always credit Styx with actually making me want to be a songwriter rather than just being an instrumentalist. That's how I sort of viewed it. And the fact that you had Styx with, particularly during their heyday, three primary songwriters being Dennis DeYoung, Tommy Shaw, and James Young. James Young always did the heavier tracks. Tommy Shaw always did the sort of folky rock tracks, and Dennis DeYoung always did the sort of more theatrical rock tracks. And that different style of writing across the three of them, and when they collaborated, was amazing. And even if one of them had written the song, you could hear the other writer's influence all across it. You could hear how Dennis had pulled Tommy away from being just an acoustic song to more rise and fall. You could hear how Tommy was adding some sort of harmony approach to his songs to create that sort of big theatrical sound. You could hear how James Young would come in and say, right, we're going to make this heavier here. And then you could hear how the other two would take James's songs from just being hard rock into, softening that sort of harder edge. And I listened to all that and thought, this is amazing. This is just fascinating how people can collaborate and work together. And so not only did they inspire that fact of songwriting, but they also inspired that idea of how collaboration can be really important to help a song. So you may have somebody that's a songwriter, but you still have to give to something that's someone else's song. And it's one of those things that Steve Howe said to me when we were recording the Yes album that became the From a Page record that I wrote quite a lot of that. And Steve said, the one thing we always do in Yes is, doesn't matter who's written the song, you give it your all. It's something you always do. You always give because it's what the song deserves. It, you shouldn't be phoning in a part because it's not your song. You know, it still takes as much time and effort to do someone else's song as it should do your own. And I thought that was really, really important. And then so many years later, when I started working with an artist called Gordon Giltrap, Gordon had worked on his own for many, many years. And he was like, oh, well, I only want to do this. And I'm not sure about it. And it's like, no, what have you got? And he would say, well, I've got this little guitar thing. It's just an instrumental. It won't probably go anywhere. And it's like, no, hand it over. I would love to see what would happen with that. And it was a whole new way of writing songs for me. Instead of sitting there on my own and thinking, how would I start this song? What story am I trying to tell? It was like, suddenly you had a little palette of something different to what you would normally create. And you would start listening to it and go, okay, so if I did this, and little song ideas would come, little melody lines would come, and before you knew it, something was being created. And I think that's what I've loved about the career that I've had so far, is that I haven't been, I don't want this to sound bad, because I know a lot of bands find a style that works for them and they follow that route. So for example, Dream Theater or Deep Purple, for example, do records in a certain way. And being a Deep Purple fan and being a Dream Theater fan, if they did anything different, I'd probably be quite upset, because I'm looking for that thing that they give me when I buy one of their records. The songs are going to be different and they'll do different things and try different sounds, but they will essentially sound like this. The difficulty that I've had is in my career, is I've been very, very excited about trying things. So one minute it'll be a rock opera record, the next minute it'll be a prog classical instrumental, the next thing it'll be a new rage record, the next time it'll be a collaboration with a folk guitarist, the next time it'll be Mother's Room, which is a five-piece rock band record, then it'll be stuff like the record I did a couple of years ago, a rock Celtic crossover with whistles and flutes and things, because it's almost like there's so many different things out there musically to play with. I kind of just want to experiment with them all and see what they bring me. And I find that fascinating. And I think that's where all these different artists that I've listened to over the years have really made a difference to me. And I value that. And I write about these people on my Facebook page. And I was astounded the other day. I wrote about a Styx record, and then somebody wrote to me and you said, did you see Dennis DeYoung from Styx wrote about one of your records? And I was like, my jaw like literally dropped. And I was like, no, you're serious. He commented, did he? And he said, no, he did a whole post on it talking about one of your records and how much he liked it. I do a sort of bi-weekly update where I posted. I wrote in here and said that Dennis had said this thing. And then he commented and said, yeah, absolutely, love the record. And you sort of go, even though somebody else looking at me with what I do would go, yeah, but you're inside that world, so why wouldn't you all be involved in that? But I'm still at heart, like most people, I'm a music fan that gets excited about, you know, the fact that other people enjoy my music, particularly people that I've been inspired by and, you know, who have actually actively influenced how I've approached my career. So, yeah, I'm still a teenage kid inside that gets excited by music and what other people do. And I still absorb music like crazy. I'm always listening to artists, hearing things. I'll be in a shop and suddenly a piece of music will come on and I'll go, most of the time I'm in there going, oh, please turn the music off because it's dreadful. But every now and then a little gem comes through and you go, what was that? And you all click on the old phone and it tells you who it was. And it's like, oh, wow. And then you suddenly start discovering new music. And the worst one for me for that is the TV show House. They play so much great music on that show that whenever it comes on, you just keep pausing it every now and then to try and find out what the music was he was playing, because it's amazing. But yeah, so it's been it's been an interesting ride. But other people's music is definitely drives me.
You've been listening to a conversation with Oliver Wakeman. His new album, Mother's Rune, 20th Anniversary Edition, is out March 13th. You can learn more about Wakeman and see his current concert dates, including a series of shows with his father, Rick, in the U.S., via his official website, oliverwakeman.co.uk. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, KMUW.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@KMUW.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, I'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson.